Bankless Nation, it's time for State of the Nation. The topic today is DeFi broken? That's the question we raise. It's from a post that was written that caught our attention. Why DeFi is broken and how to fix it. Part one, Oracle free protocols. How is DeFi broken, David? And how do Oracle free protocols fix it? Actually, that's going to be the topic of the show. So don't give me the answer. But why are we exploring this topic? Give us some context.
Yeah, the guests on today's show, longtime Bankless listeners will become completely familiar with Dan Elitzer, who has written a number of articles that have, I think, all turned into Bankless episodes because he has the uncanny ability. He's got a great hit rate. And so when Dan writes an article, I pay attention. He doesn't write too many. He conserves his bullets for that when he shoots one, it really means something. And he shot a bullet. And so we are going to go and explore why Dan thinks DeFi is broken and what DeFi needs in order to really not lose $3.8 billion like it did last bull market.
Oh, oopsies.
Yeah, 3.8. That was a number. So that's the topic of today's show. But before we get into the show, we got to talk about to our friends and sponsors at Consensus, because they would like you to make sure that you know that you can get some fuzzing going on.
If they also don't want you to lose $3.8 billion.
Yes, similarly, on theme, they also don't want you to lose $3.8 billion. So if you have not fuzzed your contracts with Consensus's diligence fuzzing tool, there's a link in the show notes to go fuzz your contracts. I'm not going to explain what fuzzing is because I've already done that too many times. It's probably too cringe. But if you are a code developer and you would like your code to not get exploited or hacked, or code developer, yeah,
not cringe at all.
We have some podcasters. Anyways, make sure that your code does not get exploited and doesn't lose $3.8 billion.
We're trying to help you. It's what David's saying.
If you ever do make a smart contract that hosts $3.8 billion, congratulations. I hope you use Consensus's diligence fuzzing tool to get to that point. There's a link in the show notes to get started with that.
Yeah. If you're not fuzzing, what are you doing? David, there's also another thing we have to mention. I think that's happening tomorrow, right?
Yes.
We have a, what is this? A dad's chat with dads?
Yeah, dads are chatting with dads. Bankless and Blockworks, two founders, two pairs of founders are going to have a Twitter space together. So if you are interested in crypto native media, I would assume you are because you are listening to this. Me and Ryan are going to be talking to Jason and Yano from Blockworks. So we're bringing some questions for them. They're bringing some questions for us. We're just going to chat about what it's like in the world of crypto native media, because this last bear market has also rocked the world of crypto native media. CoinDesk is under. There's lots to talk about. Yeah. Anyways, so that's happening tomorrow. BYOB specifically tomorrow
what
at
time?
12,
my time.
12 p.m. Eastern time on Twitter. So if you're a Twitter person, that is what we are going to be doing at 12 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. Today, if you are listening to this on the podcast feed.
So is DeFi broken? Is the question today? I really feel like man, it's been a while since we've done an entire podcast dedicated towards DeFi. And yet what's ironic here, David, is that's where we started.
That's why we're here. Yeah.
The reason Bankless started is because we were like, oh, you know, the industry isn't talking about DeFi enough. Mm-hmm. Like the thing that actually makes us fully Bankless. And yet I feel like while our protocols have experienced tremendous success and DeFi now has clear product market fit, there's something missing.
Right.
Like, are we working on a new narrative? Everyone's talking about, okay, this is the next bull run, that'll kind of fix things. It still feels like we've got some things to build in the stack here at the kind of the core primitive layer. So I think that's on deck for today. Why else are we talking about this? What's more context?
I think this episode will pull in some themes that we've been talking around on Bankless since day one. The protocol, when I was reading Dan's article, the protocol sync thesis came to mind. The other image that came to mind is, you know, that that meme of like apes evolving into men. And then like, there's like, it's like the Darwin picture. There's like seven of them. But then there's the joke of like, the last one is like, wait, we've gone too far, turn back. I feel like that's what DeFi has been for like the last like 18 months. It's like we skipped a step. And I think that's what Dan is saying. It's like, wait a second. We've gone too far. We skipped a step. We have to go back.
Yep.
And we have to go back to progress forward.
Yep.
And so the words primitives are going to be said in this podcast. I'm going to bring up the protocol sync thesis, which we'll define later in the show, and risk dependencies and oracles. These are all going to be themes about why Dan thinks that perhaps we should kind of kind of go back to the drawing board, at least in a couple certain respects, just to be able to actually progress forward in the world of DeFi innovation. So that's the context I would leave Bankless listeners to.
I think the theme is back to the basics. This is going to sound a little bit like a 2020, circa Bankless 2020 type of episode where we're talking about these fundamentals. Yeah. Remember that? Yeah. I can't wait to dive into this. Guys, we're going to get right to Dan in just a second. But before we do, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible, including our number one recommended crypto exchange, Kraken. Go create an account.
Kraken Pro has easily become the best crypto trading platform in the industry. The place I use to check the charts and the crypto prices, even when I'm not looking to place a trade. On Kraken Pro, you'll have access to advanced charting tools, real-time market data, and lightning-fast trade execution, all inside their spiffy new modular interface. Kraken's new customizable modular layout lets you tailor your trading experience to suit your needs. Pick and choose your favorite modules and place them anywhere you want in your screen. With Kraken Pro, you have that power. Whether you are a seasoned pro or just starting out, join thousands of traders who trust Kraken Pro for their crypto trading needs. Visit pro.kraken.com to get started today.
Mantle is a brand new high-performance Ethereum Layer 2 network, built differently from the other Layer 2s you may be familiar with. Mantle is a modular Layer 2 built on the OP stack, but uses EigenLayer's data availability solution instead of the expensive Ethereum Layer 1. Not only does this reduce Mantle's gas fees by 80% compared to other Layer 2s, but it also reduces gas fee volatility. Mantle has a decentralized sequencer set, eliminating the risk of downtime and censorship on the network. And because Mantle implements multi-party computation nodes, Layer 1 settlement execution is shortened from 7 days to as low as just 1 or 2. Mantle is the first Layer 2 built by a DAO and is backed by one of the biggest DAO treasuries in the world, BitDAO. Mantle already has sub-communities from around Web3 onboarded to help the growth of Mantle, like Game7 for Web3 gaming, or EduDAO for the world of DeSci, and Bybit for TVL, liquidity, and on-ramps. Check out Mantle at mantle.xyz and follow them on Twitter at 0xmantle. Immutable is at the forefront of Web3 gaming, on a mission to bring digital ownership to every player, offering the world's best games and game development platform. Immutable lets game builders and players focus on great gaming experiences. So, build your next Web3 game on easy mode with Immutable's leading full-stack Web3 gaming platform. Its built-in UX features, like the Immutable Passport, are designed for games to scale to the next billion players coming to Web3. With Immutable, players can sign up with an email, pay with a credit card, and experience a frictionless purchase flow inside of games. So discover your next favorite game and explore a network of 150 games building on Immutable, including such titles as Gods Unchained, Guilds of Guardians, Illuvium, Ember Sword, and Metalcore. So join Web3's largest ecosystem of games and players. Build, play, and connect at immutable.com.
Bankless Nation, I would love to introduce you to Dan Elitzer, a partner at Nascent, a VC firm that specializes in deep crypto economic primitives. You may remember Dan as the guy who wrote, I don't know, about the threat of liquid staking derivatives back when he called them the death of Ethereum, as in delegated ether. Now we call them LSDs. And that was 3 years before proof of stake was even a thing. Maybe you remember him from writing about superfluid collateral in 2019, which was a huge precursor to what became yield farming, which he also wrote about yield farming called aquaponic yield farming in DeFi. I think in June of 2020, right before DeFi summer, and then also wrote Unichain is inevitable, a thesis on the inevitability of app chains. All of these things have more or less come true with varying degrees of success. I would say very strong degrees of success. And all of them have also become Bankless podcast episodes. And Dan has also recently released an episode, an article, Why DeFi is Broken and How to Fix It. And so here we have Dan on the show today. Dan, welcome back to the Bankless for, I think, like the fourth or fifth time. It's good to have you back, my man.
Thanks, guys. Always great talking with you.
Thanks for helping us produce all that content, too, man. I feel like you've earned a co-host status here or something.
Hey, anytime. I'm always happy to chat.
But on that note, like, how do you decide when you are going to write an article? Because you, like I said in the intro, you conserve. You're not like Dan Elitzer every single week. You're not shooting your shot left and right. What does it take for Dan to actually put pen down on paper?
Well, A, I'm trying to ramp up the frequency here a little bit, which is one of the reasons why this was part one. I wanted to kind of publicly commit myself, but you can't wait 6 months for a part two. Yeah. But really, when I write, it tends to be because I'm seeing a trend and I'm seeing enough teams, enough people talking about similar themes. And then I try to pull it together and express it in a way where I have the great fortune to be exposed to a lot of really talented builders and be talking to them all the time. And so I see some things and some patterns a little bit before I think a lot of other people have the opportunity to. And so when I'm seeing these patterns emerging, I then try to take it and condense it and articulate it in a way that I think will help it click for more people the way it started to click for me. And to be clear, I don't know where things are necessarily going, right? I'm not claiming that I can see these things. I'm just seeing possible futures and trying to make the case for that future as clearly as I can if I think it's a future that is worth considering, worth discussing.
Well, we definitely want to get into what that trend is. But first, can we just establish what the problem is? The trend is here to fix things. But does that imply that something is broken? What about the current state of crypto? What about the current state of DeFi is broken?
Well, like you, I mean, I really got into this space with first Bitcoin, thinking of it in what was actually a DeFi context before the term DeFi even existed, but saying, hey, how do we actually make financial services available permissionlessly for the world? And I think we've made incredible progress with this experiment, but we've also had huge problems. And I think when you look at that headline number, you know, $3.8 billion being stolen in these hacks and these exploits just in 2022, right? Not even the full bull run, right? That was just last year. And that is just, I think, a couple orders of magnitude higher than an acceptable rate if we really want this to be the future of the kind of global financial system. And we can't expect to be able to recommend to our friends, our relatives, entire countries and communities that they should be using DeFi when there is still this much money being stolen through vulnerabilities. And I think it is a tractable problem. I do think that teams need to do a better job taking high quality audits and security practices seriously. But I also think that just doing more of the same is not going to get us to that orders of magnitude improvement that we need to have in order to really be able to advocate normal kind of non-tech forward people like ourselves be using this and being comfortable putting their life savings into these systems.
So Dan, are you positing though that the big scalability, the big thing we're missing in DeFi, the big reason it's broken is hacks, stolen money, $3.8 billion. Is that the real reason that DeFi is kind of broken and not taking off, you know, as quickly as we might hope?
I don't think it's the only reason. Certainly, I think there's a lot of other things we need to work on too. But I think that if we don't make meaningful improvement on the security front, it's never going to be able to be mainstream without improving security. And if we manage to improve on UX, improve on the way that we onboard people into the ecosystem, the way people manage recovery, the way they understand protocols and interact with them, if we manage to fix all those other things without addressing security, we're actually doing a disservice to the world, because that's just going to mean it's easier for more people to lose more money.
Yeah, the worst right? user experience is like the one we got with SBF and FTX, where it's like,
exactly,
hey, the exchange is so fast, but oops, doesn't have any of my money.
Right, so it's not just about like smart contract vulnerabilities, right? It also is finding ways to better like self-police, hopefully within the industry, around things like, you know, scams and bad actors, both at the kind of company level, at the project level, at the, like, you know, Twitter spam, Telegram spam and scams, WhatsApp scams, all these things. Like, we need to make progress. The number one thing holding back the industry is retail users in particular getting wrecked, right? Because then people don't trust it. They don't want to use these things. They get a bad impression. They get, it makes sense that regulators would want to come in and regulate when they're seeing retail users getting wrecked, because that is their responsibility, right? As they see it, is that they're supposed to help keep people safe. And if people are not safe, then they're going to feel like they need to step in, even if they really don't understand this thing and don't want to be touching it in the first place.
So that $3.8 billion number that you cited, you're not saying that is because of one specific part of DeFi. It is a global problem. There are many different types of hacks.
Perhaps absolutely.
Perhaps that's why there's part two coming, maybe more parts after that. But let's focus in on what the content is around part one. What is broken about the current state of DeFi that is leaky in the capital? Like, why is DeFi vulnerable, and why does the current flavor of DeFi that we have not suitable to scale up to the masses?
Yeah, so I think that the major problem here, that, you know, oracles fit in the headline, but it's not fundamentally about oracles, right? It's about thinking with a layered approach to how protocols are being designed. One of the things that we've spent a lot of time focused on at Nascent recently has been around security and really understanding the whole security process, the security stack, and working with both portfolio companies and looking at other code bases and understanding how hard it really is to go in and understand the surface area of a contract, all the things that could potentially go wrong with it. And so our view is that the right way to do this is to start with a primitive. And a primitive is a contract or set of contracts with zero external dependencies. And an oracle is a type of external dependency. Governance and upgradability are massive external dependencies. And so if you have to reason about all the possible values that could be changed or different ways in which external data can be brought onto chain in both an accurate and timely manner, and how even if slight deviations in that accuracy or that timeliness can cause really bad consequences for the protocol, for users of the protocol, that the more we can strip that out at the lowest level, the better. And there are absolutely very good reasons to be using oracles, to have governance, to have forms of upgradability. But the point is, we want to be very explicit about the range of scenarios in which those come into play. When do those dependencies matter? And what can we have and reason about and allow to be used that does not have external dependencies?
So it's been a while since we've done an episode on oracles, and I think that we should kind of go back and reestablish how oracles are actually used in some of the most popular DeFi protocols today. So what is an oracle? Are we talking about a price oracle? What does it do? What are some of the popular DeFi applications that make use of this? And can you describe that in some more detail?
I think the number one thing that oracles are used for today is around price oracles. Now, oracles are a very general tool overall, right? And I think that Chainlink in particular and a number of others have made great progress on being able to bring various types of data that is exogenous to blockchains, right? Take real world data, things that occur that can't be defined within Ethereum or other blockchains natively. And how do we import that data? How do we bring it on chain? And I think one of the ways that people have tried to get price data via an oracle on chain without pulling it in off chain via Chainlink or something similar has been to use these kind of TWAPs, the time-weighted average price, pulling it from Uniswap or other places. The problem is those have a very, very strong trade-off between how essentially accurate and timely the price is and how manipulable it is, because TWAPs over a, say, 10-minute period, pretty easy to manipulate for a lot of assets. Over a 24-hour period, pretty hard to manipulate for most assets. But if you're trying to do, you know, perps with 50x leverage, you can't look back at the average price over a 24-hour period. You want it closer to that 10-minute window. And so there's this inherent trade-off with doing stuff in this very robust on-chain way. And so Chainlink and other providers who are pulling things in off-chain really look to change how you approach that trade-off.
So we have the slow oracles that are kind of on-chain with kind of the TWAP thing that you mentioned, which is this is something that Uniswap and other protocols like it sort of brought the market, but we're still missing that fast oracle to give us kind of up to the second, up to the minute types of prices. And so there's an external off-chain dependency if you want prices like that. So what popular protocols are using, say, a Chainlink or some sort of off-chain oracle in order to actually do what they do? Is it a lot of them?
Pretty much all of them, right? If you look at, you know, Compound, Aave, any of these lending protocols today, any derivatives protocols, all like Synthetics and GMX and others, like they're all using a form of price oracle. Most of them are using Chainlink.
Dan, if Chainlink went down, how effed would we be?
Be pretty bad, right? And I think, you know, a lot of folks commenting rightly pointed out, like, they're actually, it's, you'd be hard pressed to come up with an example of an exploit where Chainlink did not function as advertised and where the exploit was due to Chainlink. And I'm not at all claiming that there is. I think the problem is that we are now using Chainlink in such a way that if there is a problem with Chainlink, it creates a problem across all of DeFi on like basically every different blockchain or L2. It's not just Ethereum that would be affected here. And so I think that, you know, again, they performed very well so far. And while, you know, there's always room for improvement, and I think Chainlink has done a great job improving over the years. I remember some of the early protocols used in Chainlink, and there was a lot of kind of performance and reliability concerns back in the day that have largely been addressed. But this really is on a go forward basis, right? What I'm thinking about is, hey, the next bull run, what are the things that if we don't get ourselves on solid footing now that we're going to regret? Because when the bull runs happen, you guys know, right? Everything gets crazy. People are just like trying to like, you know, go to the moon as fast as possible.
Short-termism sets in.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. So I think that that is the thing that we need to be doing during these quieter periods is like taking a step back and saying, hey, even if stuff has been working so far, what is the kind of like technical debt, right? Ecosystem debt that we can clean up? I would put USDT is pretty high on that list as well, is like just, hey, USDT has been fine so far, but there's a lot of reasons that people have been concerned for years and continue to be concerned. And so like, let's find these things, having a single Oracle or single Oracle network as the dependency for everything, having USDT as dependency for everything. How do we start really diversifying the risk here? Because that is what we're trying to build, right? Is a more robust financial system. And just because a bank isn't the single point of failure doesn't mean that we don't want to find more ways that people can choose the trade-offs, choose the risk models that they want. And again, no one's going to be choosing directly and piecing together every single piece of the stack, but having composable layers that people can choose service providers or other protocols that are piecing together the different dependencies and creating the right end user product. I think that's the exciting thing here, right? The fact that we have these permissionless protocols underneath, especially primitives at the base layer, and that you can build whatever you want on top of it. I think that is what excites me.
And that's really the call to action that you're presenting in your article. This we've been talking a lot about oracles, and I just really want to double down on this is actually not an oracle conversation. It's deeper than the oracle.
It's dependencies generally. Right?
Dependencies generally, yes. Oracles being the biggest one, the biggest systemic issue that we might have as an external dependency, but it's the fact that we rely on external dependencies in the first place, which is the area of emphasis that you're bringing to the conversation. And you said this word, exogenous dependency, exogenous to the, to the blockchain system, right? Something external needs to come into our DeFi apps in order to make them work. And that an exogenous dependency is also risk. And I think what you're trying to advocate for are not just the reduction, the elimination of exogenous dependencies, but also producing what we need would otherwise need as like an external oracle, but being able to produce it internally so that we can actually, it's like an inversion. Can you walk us through like this part of this conversation?
Yeah, I think a lot of what we see now is like the kind of centralized exchange world and the things that exist outside of blockchains, just they're much, much bigger than the on-chain kind of like ecosystem today. And we've been kind of catching up, right? As DeFi has grown, as usage of protocols has grown, that gap has shrunk. And eventually, I hope and I believe we will hit this tipping point where the on-chain volume is actually higher than the off-chain volume, right? The activities that is happening in this kind of crypto native on-chain context will become the primary market, not the secondary market, where we need to refer off-chain to data from the primary market. And we've already seen that with certain assets that have gotten very large before getting a listing on a centralized exchange, but there is still much deeper liquidity for them within DeFi. And that's awesome, but that's the exception. And I hope someday the rule will be stuff is more liquid, the primary market is happening on chain, and then we don't have to pipe in information from off chain as much. We can be more reliant on things that are wholly on chain. But to date, that's been a really bad idea to make that assumption because the primary market has been off chain. So let's design in a way where we can eventually transition to a more on chain centric world where the dependencies can be fully defined and are not subjecting to the very complicated process of bringing in data outside of a blockchain context and bringing it on chain.
By the way, for people who are like, well, Dan, we'll always have centralized exchanges and you're living in this fantasy crypto world. I remember when back in 2019, people, this is Grandpa Ryan coming out. I remember when 2019, people said decentralized exchanges would never take off. And if you looked at the market share in 2019, so that's just 4 years ago, 0.06% of spot trade volume happened on decentralized exchanges. The other 99% was on centralized exchanges. You know where we are now? We're at 20%. All right? Decentralized exchanges are now up to 20% 4 years later. Basically nothing. I'm still impressed, David. All right. And by the way, much higher post, guess what? SBF, FTX, all that whole mess. So this kind of thing can happen. And it gets to the core of actually what we mean when we say DeFi. Because remember that guy, Alex Mashinsky, was saying, I got some DeFi for you. Come on over to Celsius. I'll give you some DeFi. It wasn't really DeFi. If you go to kind of the most extreme version of what DeFi is, on the fully decentralized side of the spectrum, it would be something that doesn't have any external off-chain dependency, no exogenous type of data source. And so something like Ether, the asset, is very on-chain, right? It has no external dependency. That is a very much economic bandwidth DeFi. Probably the closest protocol we've seen, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but that's hit kind of mainstream, is something like Uniswap, which really has it has its own oracle. It doesn't require some sort of
it produces like a TWAP that you can use other places, but like it fundamentally doesn't need an oracle. It is people just trading, right?
Right.
And it produces an oracle. It does not ingest an oracle.
Yeah.
The more off-chain sort of dependencies you inject, the less DeFi something becomes until you're kind of like all the way to Alex Mashinsky, I suppose. So what we're talking about is getting back to the core of like DeFi by trying to like reduce. I feel like we've become complacent somewhat a little bit in that we're like, oracles work and these, you know, governance dependencies, whatever. I mean, we're just kind of papering over some things. And what you're saying is, hey, let's, while we're sober now, because we're sober, it's 2023, no one's drunk on the hype of whatever bull market. Let's shore this up. Let's make sure we get this right. I think that's what you're saying here.
Right. And I think it's an idea about having choices along the spectrum, right? Like if you look at Celsius, you look at FTX, like, right, they were just like scamming basically. But if you think about what is the kind of future state look like, it is not an incredibly purist, everybody is doing everything fully on chain with zero external dependencies. But I think Andreas Antonopoulos had a great bit that he did, you know, years ago, where he talked about what is the benefit of having kind of permissionless systems and permission systems. How do they coexist? And his point was, you can build a permissioned system on top of a permissionless system. You fundamentally cannot build a permissionless system on top of a permissioned system. And so I think for DeFi, similarly, what we're talking about here is let's actually start with this incredibly low attack surface, zero external dependency, low level primitive. And then you can build things on top that have dependencies, and you can choose which dependencies. And if you want to go all the way to something that, you know, is a fully centralized custodial KYC'd service that is built on top of that, you can, and that can still be built on top of the same base level primitive. But people can choose kind of like what is their point along that spectrum, what services do they want to trust, while still actually concentrating all of the liquidity, all of the economic exchange at the base layer can be happening in this very secure shared market.
But Dan, building DeFi apps like that is hard.
It is hard. It's so hard, right? And that's what we haven't seen a lot of it. And so we've been cutting corners. But I think also, you know, and this might be another controversial point. I think, you know, AMMs, automated market makers, you know, that Uniswap really helped popularize, have been a real leap forward and have allowed DeFi to get to where it is today. And we tried the pure kind of like order book style peer-to-peer exchanges for both trading and for lending markets prior to that. None of them worked. AMMs were what allowed it to break through. They improved usability given the constraints of like kind of like low user base, small user base, and just like low throughput, high cost doing stuff on chain early on. AMMs were great. I think we're actually going to circle back. We're actually going to end up like the ultimate efficient end state is we're going to have things that are much, much closer to order books than to AMMs as they exist today. And I think Uni V3 was a big step in that direction with concentrated liquidity being effectively a gas efficient on-chain order book. And we're going to see more shifting in that direction. So it's hard to do certain things. We've kind of got to look at how things are going to evolve over time. And so a lot of the things about layering and thinking about what is possible with these isolated markets, what is possible for going this pure no dependency version of DeFi, that wasn't possible previously. It was tried in various forms, but it wasn't really possible. Now I think we've evolved to the state where we have enough users, we have enough liquidity, we can be more thoughtful about building the architecture that is actually long-term and robust because we've gone through an initial bootstrapping period to get there. So this isn't necessarily, some ideas are probably just like bad and wrong. Other ideas, the timing is off. And then you think that it just means that this architecture is wrong. This idea is wrong. It was wrong for the time, but now we can do it with advantages that didn't exist before. And it is, I think the people who were trying to do those things weren't wrong that those were the right ways directionally to build up a decentralized financial system, the timing was just off.
So Dan, how many DeFi apps check this box as a very deep primitive that has no external dependencies? We got Uniswap. How many apps after that?
Yeah, it's pretty slim pickings in terms of like what's live today. I think there are a few that have hopped out. I think it was Panoptic may have called out for like Oracle free options that they may have actually originated the term of kind of like Oracle free protocols. There's others. I think was it Timeless or others that have been doing this in various forms. I think finding the right way to not completely mess up, you know, UX and actually keep the liquidity there, keep the UX up to par is tough. And so but I'm seeing this kind of wave of folks coming, both ones that we've invested in nascent, ones that we haven't invested in, like the two mentioned previously. I think that there's this trend coming and we're going to see how it plays out. I think it has potential to be a lot more robust and that if we are thoughtful, if we've got teams like Oasis, like DeFi Saver and others who are building on top of some of these, you know, that's going to be very helpful to maintain a consistent UX on a solider base. And I think that there are many, many more services and protocols that will build on top of these if they can get the initial traction going, such that the average DeFi user today will see equal UX while having essentially a more robust stack that has been built up to support that.
So Uniswap is one, but we'll talk about how all the other major DeFi apps that have TVL do not check this box. So we got Aave, we got Compound, we got MakerDAO, which will be, I think, the next, like, synthetics, I think, all have an external oracle.
Yeah.
And so I think what really you're saying is, like, hey,
anything
whole,
with lending, derivatives, all of this stuff is using external price oracles. Yeah.
Basically, if you're not using Uniswap, you're probably using an external dependency. And an external dependency is just a fancy way of saying bank, I'll say. If you really want to generalize what a bank is, it's like somebody that can control your funds in ways that you don't agree with. And so very, very generalized.
Yes,
very,
yes and no. I think the custody distinction is really important, right?
Yeah,
because a lot of these things, they don't have custody of your funds. They could, in theory, be upgraded in a way that is, like, ends up resulting in them taking custody or being very custody-like in these things. So I think that is an important distinction, but the fact that there could be these, like, really bad upgrades that could happen means that, like, man, we better hope that the governance systems are robust. And I don't think there's anybody who's been deeply involved in governance for any of these DeFi protocols that has, like, their view is like, oh yeah, governance works great. I love it. I feel totally comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So maybe to be less hyperbolic, not a bank, but trust. Like, these things aren't a bank, but they do, but you do have to trust them to not turn into a bank if the wrong governance proposal went through. And this, like, this goes right back to the roots of what, like, Ryan and I got into DeFi in the first place, right? It's like, hey, what about bankless finance? What about trustless finance? Like, my Twitter name is called Trustless State. And so I think what you're saying is, like, hey, all these DeFi apps beyond Uniswap haven't been trustless. And so we need to get back to our trustless roots. Dan, I know you've got a number of protocols. I want to pick your brain out to understand how these things are actually built. And if we're going to do, like, lending without an oracle, how does that even work? And how this is kind of, like, inverting the model, as we know, to build and produce a new set of perhaps permissionless, trustless, oracle-free protocols. But before we get to that part of the conversation, a moment to talk about these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible.
Learning about crypto is hard. Until now. Introducing MetaMask Learn, an open educational platform about crypto, Web3, self-custody, wallet management, and all the other topics needed to onboard people into this crazy world of crypto. MetaMask Learn is an interactive platform with each lesson offering a simulation for the task at hand, giving you actual, practical experience for navigating Web3. The purpose of MetaMask Learn is to teach people the basics of self-custody and wallet security in a safe environment. And while MetaMask Learn always takes the time to define Web3-specific vocabulary, it is still a jargon-free experience for the crypto-curious user. Friendly, not scary. MetaMask Learn is available in 10 languages with more to be added soon, and it's meant to cater to a global Web3 audience. So, are you tired of having to explain crypto concepts to your friends? Go to learn.metamask.io and add MetaMask Learn to your guides to get onboarded into the world of Web3.
Hiring people worldwide, paying them in crypto, providing them access to benefits, it all's so complex. But it doesn't have to be. Complying with labor laws, payroll rules, tax obligations, and crypto regulations in every country that you employ someone is difficult, time-consuming, manual, and costly. And it's drawing more and more attention from regulators and governments. But there is good news. Toku is here. Toku is the first employment and compensation platform for the crypto industry that makes this easy. Toku helps you hire employees or contractors and pay them in fiat or crypto legally, compliantly, and with all the taxes handled in over 100 different jurisdictions. So whether you're an early stage company with just a team of two, or you're an enterprise with 200, Toku has a solution that meets your needs. Toku is already working with the leading companies in the space, Protocol Labs, Hedera, Gitcoin, and many more. So transform your employment and token payroll operations with Toku. You can reach out to Toku at toku.com/bankless or click the link in the show notes. Introducing ETHX from Stater. ETHX is a liquid staking token designed to maximize rewards, all while securing Ethereum. With Stater, you can run an Ethereum node with just 4 ETH, an 85% lower capital requirement versus the 32 ETH required for solo staking. With Stater's 4 ETH nodes, you can get a 35% average higher yield, since you charge fees to those who use your node to stake their ETH. By running a node with Stater, the ETHX staking derivative token can get minted on your validators and can flow into the world of DeFi. which Dater is actively building integrations and partnerships into to increase the utility of ETHX. Dater allows for both permissioned and permissionless nodes to join the network, maximizing its potential scalability for ETHX, while preserving the values of decentralization and openness behind its liquid staking token. Go to staterlabs.com/ETH and sign up to get access to the Stater staking protocol. Arbitrum One is pioneering the world of secure Ethereum scalability and is continuing to accelerate the Web3 landscape. Hundreds of projects have already deployed on Arbitrum One, producing flourishing DeFi and NFT ecosystems. With the recent addition of Arbitrum Nova, gaming and social dApps like Reddit are also now calling Arbitrum home. Both Arbitrum One and Nova leverage the security and decentralization of Ethereum and provide a builder experience that's intuitive, familiar, and fully EVM compatible. On Arbitrum, both builders and users will experience faster transaction speeds with significantly lower gas fees. With Arbitrum's recent migration to Arbitrum Nitro, it's also now 10 times faster than before. Visit arbitrum.io, where you can join the community, dive into the developer docs, bridge your assets, and start building your first dApp. With Arbitrum, experience Web3 development the way it was meant to be. Secure, fast, cheap, and friction-free.
Bankless Nation, we are back with Dan exploring this world of primitives. God, I used to love saying that word. We haven't said that word in a while. Dan, with all of our DeFi apps that we want to become primitives, is there a pattern for how Oracle-free or dependency-free DeFi apps emerge? Like, how does one actually remove an Oracle? Is there an underlying pattern that we can understand here?
Yeah. So on the trading side, like, pretty well established, right? We've seen the AMM model, XYK, and then all the variations on it. On the lending side, it's admittedly a bit more complicated. And so usually what we're seeing with, you know, with Aave, with Compound, with these other pooled lending models is you're relying on an Oracle saying like, hey, what is the price of Ether right now? And being able to say, hey, we've got these kind of universal collateral factors, basically how much can you borrow against a given, you know, set of collateral, and how much, at what point do you then start getting liquidated, right? When you move to an Oracle-free context, what you generally have is the lenders. So let's say I want to lend USDC and I'm willing to have Ether as collateral against it. I can choose essentially what is the amount of USDC that I will lend against one ETH or against 0.5 ETH or against 100 ETH, whatever it is. I can choose that ratio, and I'm implying the collateral rate that I'm comfortable with based on what I see as the current price of Ether. Now, if the price moves, that does not automatically get updated, right? And so I would need to, if I don't want to see a liquidation occur as both a borrower or a lender who wants to lend it, say, a new ratio based on the current market price of ETH, I would need to then update the terms of either the current loan or of a future loan to reflect that. And so some of these different protocols will address how that liquidation process works and how both lenders and borrowers initially express their preference in the market. But at the core, that is what's happening, is you have a quote asset and a collateral asset, and you're agreeing, like, what are the kind of ratios between these assets that both lender and borrower are comfortable with.
So instead of depending on one external oracle, you just are the oracle. You are just the one that inputs the desired ratio, and that's how you remove the oracle, simply put.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing that, you know, with NFTs in particular, right, where it's been harder to have that kind of like off-chain price. So it's like, okay, here's an NFT as collateral. Like, what are you willing to lend against it? How much are you willing to lend against it? And generally, the platforms are defining it based on the price, but you could, you know, choose what price you're comfortable with. Maybe this is a floor asset, in which case it's easy. If it's not a floor NFT, then it's going to be a lot more subjective what you consider the price to be and what you're comfortable. And so this is just saying, hey, we're not going to say we're just trusting. We're all agreeing to trust this person saying the price. It's like, no. You come in, you choose what you are comfortable with using as the price, either based on your own information or whatever other service you want to trust to provide accurate price data for your, you know, kind of risk profile preferences.
So in the history of DeFi, I remember there was, in the very early days, there was peer-to-peer lending.
Yep.
And I think that's what Aave was pre in very early days.
ETHLEND. Yeah, ETHLEND. Back in the day.
ETHLEND. Oh my ETHLEND. God. Yeah. Before it was, they pivoted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They pivoted from peer to peer where two people set the terms. Also, we had Dharma. We talked about that in the commercial break. We had, which was peer to peer, like two, like each side of the market would individually find each other and they would come to an individual agreement. And these peer to peer finance, peer to peer DeFi, just got absolutely smoked by peer to contract.
Yeah, it failed.
DeFi, it failed.
Stani had to pivot towards Aave, which is peer to contract, as he said.
And so this is what Uniswap is. This is what Aave is. This is what MakerDAO is. It's like instead of having to matchmake between individuals, you just go to the contract, and the contract is the aggregator between all the marketplaces. And so what I heard you say is something much more closer to the peer-to-peer world, where two individual people come together and have to come up with terms, and then they can make an agreement, and that's how we get rid of the oracle. But then we introduce a problem of liquidity. How do you have, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so there are multiple ways to get there, right? And so in the case of Ajna, right, which is doing this, I would say they're using a Uni V3 style model where you have ticks based on the collateral ratios. And as a lender, you deposit into specific ticks. And so just like Uni V3, where you have these kind of non-fungible LP positions, where different people are LPing across different ranges, but as a trader, you can come in and trade across all of them. The same thing happens within Ajna, where lenders come in and again, they'll lend, say, USDC in certain ticks against ETH. But then if you want to come post ETH as collateral and borrow, you can access liquidity from multiple suppliers across a variety of ticks. And so I think that's how you can make it. What's one of the ways that you can make it work is we can still use this kind of like peer-to-pool model, peer-to-contract model, and just make the kind of supply side non-fungible and make it a little bit, I'd say, more intensive. But that's also natural, right? If you look at any of these peer-to-peer marketplaces, even outside of crypto, what typically happens is you see one side of the market getting professionalized very, very quickly. And then you have retail on the other side, because that's just the efficient way to do it. And that's ultimately everybody benefits. As long as you do have an open marketplace, because you make it, high barriers to entry and requirements, essentially on one side, just in terms of just how sophisticated you have to be, while allowing people on the other side to need to be less sophisticated. But as long as there is a competitive market that is operated in a fair manner, then they can't be taken advantage of.
Hmm. Is one way of saying this, though, Dan, that rather than removing the oracle, it's kind of like bring your own oracle. Maybe yep. There's a synonym here. Maybe we're saying we're the same thing. Because now that I look back at kind of Uniswap V3, right, or any of the versions of Uniswap, basically, we might say that's an oracle-less, no oracle protocol, oracle-less protocol. But actually, you kind of have to bring your own oracle, don't you? Also, you get kind of like owned. And I'm not saying a specific oracle, but you have to kind of know at what price point you're going to like LP. You have to kind of set your ranges yourself. Yeah. You have to sort of bring some sort of source of knowledge, whether you call it an oracle or not. So maybe that was already bring your own oracle, and that's what you're saying. We could do the same with lending and borrowing. Am I understanding this? Like, how would you articulate this?
Yeah, more or less. And I think the same way that we've seen as Uni V3, you know, has made it harder to LP, that there have been a number of different services and protocols that have popped up to make it easy for retail users to LP for certain types of pools in certain ways, because they're kind of monitoring and bringing in this external information for you. But if you want to go and use it raw yourself, you can. But there's essentially a lot of, even if we don't call them options, effectively people are offering forms of options when they're LPing, either in DEXs or in lending protocols. And here it's just being made more explicit, where there is essentially embedded options in a lot of the LP activity that's happening in these Oracle-free versions of lending protocols, and also various, if you want to get to like Oracle-free derivatives, absolutely, that's a big piece of this, is you're effectively embedding options, but in such a way that you don't have to like go deep on options pricing and theory to be able to use these protocols in various ways. But you probably do, for at least one side of the market, want to outsource your LPing to somebody who has that level of knowledge, whether it's an individual, whether it's a centralized service, whether it's a decentralized protocol, any of that is possible.
And the advantage of this design is if a Chainlink Oracle goes dark, like the entire protocol doesn't just kind of disintegrate, which could be the case with many Oracle designed protocols today. Like really bad things happen if the price feed kind of stops.
Goes erratic.
Yes. Well, absolutely. And to be clear, that hasn't really happened. And also, if you think about it, let's say that, you know, 95% of people are relying on then Chainlink via services built on top of the Oracle Free Protocol. That doesn't necessarily like help overall, except that the way these protocols are then designed is saying, okay, we're actually effectively embedding puts in the liquidity provision piece of this. And so you're saying, hey, worst case, if this can't be liquidated in an efficient manner, I will accept this collateral at this ratio in return. And so therefore you have already said like, hey, worst case scenario, Oracle's down, whatever happens, here is essentially the arbitrated outcome that will take place, as opposed to saying like, oh man, now look, this pool is insolvent, the protocol is insolvent, everyone's like beating it to the exits, we've got all these problems. It's keeping risk much more isolated and more clearly defining what happens in extreme market dislocation situations. And I think that is very powerful, because we've seen time and again where the like manipulation of, you know, price feeds for certain assets, whether on chain or off chain, or exploits or other things, protocols will end up in a state where like the DAO is like, well, what do we do? And try to figure out like what is the right way to handle it, because different people have different expectations, and there's not like necessarily a clear way that this is supposed to be resolved, because by definition, when these things happen, they were unexpected. And then we said, governance will deal with it. And I think it's better if we say, okay, look, you were coming in, you were getting the rewards, there's risks, and they're very clear up front. And yes, we can use external tools, other things to help manage those, but fundamentally, you need to know what you're getting into, and you can choose different risks than I choose or than David chooses. And so we can all still be interacting in the same market with our different risk preferences and still have pooled liquidity. And I think that is what is super exciting about these protocols, is that ability to not massively fragment liquidity, but still allow individual expressions of the risks and dependencies that you're willing to accept.
No, this is very cool. I mean, this is a very clean wind down. And another word that comes to mind to describe this is kind of resilience. So these protocols would have sort of a self-healing type of nature. So one Oracle goes down, like Chainlink or something, well, guess what? The market is very incented to put another Oracle solution in place. So, you know, market participants can kind of bring their own Oracle, and the kind of the protocol self-heals. We've seen something similar with Ethereum and its multi-client architecture, right? Where we had that, you know, finalization event where Ethereum wasn't finalizing a few weeks back. And it was because there was an issue with two of the clients, it turned out. But good thing we had a third, good thing we had a fourth, and the network kind of continued to march on. This also, when you were talking, reminds me of like, this is all about maintaining fair, orderly, and efficient markets, right? It's like, orderly and efficient markets. By the way, that is the mission of the SEC. So I'm sure Gary Gensler and team would be a fan of this, or at least they would if they operated on first principles. But a higher layer a lower layer of kind of primitive that other protocols, other things can build on. And I guess we would have kind of an app layer, maybe a DeFi saver or something like this, helping individual retail users kind of manage their positions across these. So do you think, in terms of broad categories, we've talked about decentralized exchanges, and we've seen Oracle-less decentralized exchanges. Do you think the future really for lending and borrowing on in DeFi is Oracle-less lending and borrowing? Can we like take that entire category and make it Oracle-less? Are there other categories beyond lending and borrowing?
Yes, I think we can. Whether we will is very much an open question, right? I think it is absolutely possible. But to David's point, like it's hard, right? Like, or it's, or I think maybe your point, Ryan, is like it's harder than what we have been doing. It requires rebuilding some of the things that we've already been built. And can we do that fast enough? Can do people care enough to do it? I hope so, but I don't know. We might see that just like there's no demand for this in the market, and then people don't do it. And that will, you know, that's a choice that kind of like we as an industry have made, that individual users have made. But you know, I want to at least draw out this potential future path that I think would be more robust. And again, I've seen a bunch of teams that are already starting down this path, and so I want to help shine a light and bring more awareness to that. Mm-hmm. And hopefully encourage more teams to think about this path if it wasn't already something that they had in their head.
Well, I think if we're thinking with an adversarial mindset, which we should be thinking in an adversarial mindset, if it can be exploited, if it can be hacked, if something can go wrong, it will go wrong at some point in time. And so I think we should all be concerned when like 50% of the TVL is one erratic Oracle away from getting liquidated. So like, I think perhaps we should assume that that is going to happen. And I think really the question is, just like how on-chain DEX volume is up post FTX, do we want to get our on-chain borrowing and lending up into Oracle free protocols before or after there's a major Oracle exploit, I think is the big question. But either way, it's going there. It's just a matter of time. Dan,
and to be clear, this is not the only thing that we need to do to fix DeFi right. security. I think
this is just part one.
This is part one, right? So, and there's a lot of other ideas I'm sure that other people have, and I want to get the conversation going. But I'm going to be touching on topics like how do we actually introduce circuit breakers in a way that maintains permissionlessness and composability while presenting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars from just like disappearing in one transaction. How do we actually get to what I'm calling generalized multi-party sentinel contracts to basically permissionlessly delegate in a non-custodial way to multiple parties to help protect protocols and individual users? And then also really thinking a lot more about bounties and how we can have significantly larger bounties that scale with the value at risk. And create the incentives to better secure the ecosystem. So these are just a few ideas that I'm looking forward to writing about and to discussing with people. And I know there's a lot of other people that are starting to think more about security, but I started here because I think this idea of a layered approach while allowing for unified markets actually underpins a lot of those other ideas as well.
Well, Dan, thank you for coming on and walking us through this conversation. You've mentioned a handful of projects and teams, but overall, who are the leaders in this space of Oracle-free, dependency-free protocols? If people are curious to go and poke around and learn a little bit more, what are some standout projects in your mind?
Well, I mentioned a couple earlier that were very early in terms of like Panoptic and Timeless. I would say Blur's Blend is a great example of this now that has become very popular. There's a bunch of others that are coming up soon, you know, a number of which were invested in at Nascent. So that those some of these are Ajna, Ethereum Credit Guild, MetaStreet, which does kind of NFT-based lending with their automated tranche makers doing some very cool stuff. So there's a number of folks that are coming in this space and very excited to see them all be in market and see how it plays out in real life.
Well, awesome. We'll end it there. Dan, this has been great. Always game to make DeFi a bit more decentralized, I should say. Hey, we got to work on that now, right? Now it's the time. So hopefully some of these teams and projects are coming to market soon. We appreciate you sharing all this with the Bankless Nation. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me on for the discussion.
Risk and disclaimers. Got to remind you, of course, none of this has been financial advice. It never is on Bankless, ETH, DeFi. All this stuff is kind of risky. You could lose what you put in. but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.